on April 15th, tax day, in case you've forgotten to send in your taxes.
I did, don't worry.
Good for you. I guess I'm interested in hearing a little bit more about the intentional community and about your daily routines and what life was like. Could you talk some about that? I guess this would be what, between the period of 64 and 84, I guess, approximately?
Well, there was an intentional community at Austin.
Okay.
With the student house. Mm-hmm. And a lot of what we did there rubbed off on the religious houses later. But I think what you're interested in mostly is the religious houses.
I guess, and when you had the common purse, the community of goods, and...
Well, that started when we moved to Evanston.
Okay.
62.
Mm-hmm.
And in 68, we had grown to such a size on the west side, 55th city location, that we were ready then, we felt, to send people out to other locations. And we, in 1968, commissioned, I forget how many, 6 or 8 religious houses. And they went out from there and started the same life that we were living on the west side, which by that time had become the daily office in the morning. We worshiped at 5:30 in the morning. It's a 30-minute service. And then that was followed by breakfast together, where we read the scripture and discussed the news, whatever was happening in the news at the time. And had breakfast, and we ate breakfast together. There would also be announcements and mm-hmm. business type things, sometimes at the meals, but it was mostly just a meal together to start the day. 5 mornings a week, Monday through Friday. Saturday was open. And Sunday, we were usually, many of us teaching on the weekends. Mm-hmm. Friday night. Friday evening is when I started dinner, Monday through Sunday noon. I was in RS1, Religious Studies 1, and uh-huh. other courses too. We're taught on the weekend. So in the community, we allowed for that.
Right.
We brought people back for the Sunday night then. Was the house church, we called it, which term we got from Europe, where they had house churches that met in people's homes and did the Eucharist and had meals together. But we, starting in Austin, we had a house church there of the staff of the Faith and I community. We weren't living in one location, but we would meet at the Layhouse House, which was started after we started the College House. Then we started the Layhouse House, which was for the people's house.
Mm-hmm.
And at that location, the staff would meet for the Eucharist and a meal and study.
Mm-hmm.
The study part we didn't keep after we got up here.
Okay.
But in Austin, we had study too. That was our house church. And it included accountability, as I told you earlier, where you ask whether or not you'd been faithful to the rule of the order, as we understood whatever we had agreed upon to do together was the rule. It wasn't written down rule, but
and would you actually go around the room and each person would be asked, were you accountable this week?
Each person would stand
okay.
and ask. Oh, another key thing in the house church was birthday celebrations.
Mm-hmm.
We love to celebrate birthdays. And so the person who had a birthday would stand up, and the person who was to address a word to them on their birthday would stand up and would usually begin by asking them a question like, what was the most significant thing that happened to you in the last year?
Wow. Uh-huh.
And they would probably be thinking about it before they got there, but that would help because we got accustomed to doing answering that question. But you could ask them what you think they wanted to do about the importance of their birthday for them, and that helped them to know what their meaning of that birthday was, as well as the community to know. It wasn't very long, but, and then the person would say after them, got a response to the question, then they would say a word, like, your name is?
Deborah.
Mm-hmm. On occasion of your 26th birthday, I would say that you've done XXX in the past year, and next year, I would make a claim on you to do, you know, anything you wanted to say to them,
yes.
a word you wanted to say to them that was significant in your life. That was always very important, I thought. We sang a lot to start the meal, and even during it sometimes.
When you did the accountability round, if someone stood up and said they had been accountable or they had followed the order, could someone else challenge them on that if they felt they hadn't?
They could, but it was more of a ritual than it was a time to do that.
Okay.
I don't recall being asked.
So mostly someone would
stand up? Sometimes they would say no.
They'd
say
really?
Usually your answer was yes and no. Mm-hmm. I've been accountable, yes and no. And that was all yes.
You didn't have to explain?
You didn't have to explain.
Okay.
No.
If you said no, did you have to
explain?
You could
say no and yes, you didn't have to explain.
Okay.
You say yes and no, or no and yes. Mm-hmm. You're never fully accountable, and you've never been fully unaccountable.
Mm-hmm.
If you're here, you're accountable. So. And then at the end of that, the person who was leading it would pronounce absolution upon
okay.
the group for that.
So it was like confession in a way.
And we did it in very separate ways. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily religious about it.
And could you give me an example of what would lead a person to say no? I mean, what might they have done? Or to lead a person to say yes?
Well, they missed the office two times that week.
So following the rule would mean that you got up every morning and went to daily office.
Went to daily office, you did your work.
Mm-hmm. You did your obedience.
Whatever you were assigned to do. You hopefully had a family meeting during the week with your family.
So if the family unit was encouraged to get together and...
Encouraged to have a weekly meeting.
They
didn't all do it every week, but frequently they did.
Can you explain about the obedience and what... That
obedience was, some particular menial chore that was needed to be done, such as cleaning a bathroom or part of the bathroom or the hallways or some section of it, public spaces, any kind of public space. Now, you kept your own living in it for yourself, but these public spaces were taken care of by obediences.
Mm-hmm.
Then we had, as well as the obediences, had the tasks that had to be done. They weren't considered obediences. The obedience was short. You didn't have to take 10, 15 minutes. Usually you could do it. But you might also be assigned to cook the meals for that week or cook dinners for that week.
Mm-hmm.
Those were bigger tasks. Or you might be asked to wash the dishes for a week. And there were assignment schedules where you and your team would work it out with your schedule as to when you could do whatever.
And what was a team?
Well, that kind of developed depending on the size. Like a small religious house with only 3 or 4 families, you may not even have teams.
Mm-hmm.
But where there were 100 people, you might have 5 teams, 20 each or something like that. Usually, I think we were on separate teams from our family because that helped you carry out your family life. If you and your husband were on separate teams, then one of you could take care of the kids while the other did their work and that sort of thing.
Right.
So I think we usually divided the families. Mm-hmm. The kids had their own structures. Both meals separate sometimes. We like to call them the emerging generation. The emerging generation, the EG. So someone would be assigned to lead their meals. And they would do similar things at their meals, but not at the same level.
And the kids had some tasks, some obediences that they were.
Mm-hmm. And they're much more small.
Now, did you live together, did families live together in, like, did they have their own little apartment or suite of rooms or something?
They'd have at least one room,
mm-hmm.
Depending on the facilities where they are. In this building now, you have 2 rooms, usually 2 windows, they call it, because each window can be made into a room, but
mm-hmm.
most of them now are those two windows were in for apartment. And then share bathrooms. But that's just the way this facility is. Different places, there were different religious houses that would be different.
Right.
But
right.
We worked it out, whatever was being. But the family, we made a big emphasis on keeping the families separate. Mm-hmm. We were not communal to the sense of sharing.
Right.
In the family level. So we kept the individual was a basic unit, the family was the next basic unit, mm-hmm. and the house or the community was another.
Do you think, was it difficult on family life to live in a big community, or was it easier? But
I'd say it intensifies, family.
Mm-hmm.
The issues families face. Mm-hmm. We have the same grounds of difficulties society has, marital problems and things, but I don't think it's any more so much as you're sort of more under the eye of other people.
Yeah.
A lot more, but also have a chance to talk to other people.
And you'd also get some help with child care, I assume, and that might be useful, I suppose.
Yes, uh-huh. We did talk about it. And even when we went overseas, we would sometimes not be able to take our children, mm-hmm. so we'd leave them with one of the other families to take care of. And they'd have another room for them or something. But they would, one of my daughter's biggest complaints, I was never quite around as much as she would like for me to be.
Yeah.
But she did go with us to Singapore, to Australia,
wow.
the Philippines, Germany.
And she can't complain too much then, right? If she got that kind of a
there were
an
times
education.
When it would have been better if we'd been here that way.
Right. It must have been kind of nice, though, for the kids, too, to have a lot of peers, I suppose, to grow up with.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I always vowed, I was an only child myself, mm-hmm. and I'd always vowed that I would never have an only child. Mm-hmm. I did end up having daughter, but she did grow up in a community,
yeah.
and I think it was helpful that she did. Mm-hmm. She may not always admit that, but mm-hmm. I think it was more helpful than that. Mm-hmm. You just become more outgoing with other children.
How do people spend their days? Did they go outside to earn an income that
some
they then
people,
brought back? Or?
Some people mm-hmm. did. Some people were on, we call it permeation. Give it a missional emphasis. We said that they were there and that job that they got to share the mission with whoever they could. That didn't mean doing anything out of the way, but if they were a secretary or a lawyer or a doctor or whatever, they had a purpose in that for one of the persons was to be a good doctor, mm-hmm. whatever that required.
Was it also to talk about the community and let people know what you were doing? To be
many
evangelical
people,
in a sense,
many
I suppose?
People did. It's hard. We weren't mm-hmm. out to say people ought to live like we do.
Mm-hmm.
We never tried to convert society to our way of living. In fact, we said this is not the life for everybody. But we would share it at times when it was appropriate, but it wasn't appropriate. We did.
Yeah. How did you get along with your neighbors in the surrounding community?
Sometimes they thought we were a bit strange,
uh-huh.
especially in those religious houses. When we were in Evanston, we had some difficulties with the legal requirements of people being under one roof. But on the west side, we were living in a old seminary grounds over there. It was the Bethany Church of the Brethren Seminary. And they left, went to the suburbs, built a new facility. And it had a hospital across the street from it, even as a church of brother. And so we were living on a campus, really, in the buildings that were used for students to live, going to seminary there. And faculty also lived on the campus, in that case. And it was never raised as a difficulty. The difficulty with the neighborhood there was more, it was a ghetto. It was a black community. It was prone to the violence and drugs and things that we know ghettos are tended to. And so it was a dangerous neighborhood to live in, as is this one here in uptown. You don't go out at night by yourself, whether you're here or there. And so those kind of relations were there, but in terms of our presence as a community, it was more when we started the religious studies. After that, it was more when we started the religious studies.
Mm-hmm.
And that would vary from location to location. San Francisco was hardly any Pullman at all, but Montana might be no more questions raised about us and so forth. But usually, we didn't usually set up a house someplace where we didn't have a lot of friends and people who knew us already.
Right.
Because we had done programs in those areas.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way, in fact, the members of the houses, the ones that joined the order, were people from our programs. And that includes people who came to Chicago to live, as well as people who joined the houses. After they started, some of them would be from Chicago and moved there, but others would be from that area.
Mm-hmm.
And so that helped to both know the surrounding community and neighborhood as well as relate to it. And there were also people that were not in the houses, people who had been to courses or people who had served on our board of directors or given us money to support the institute work at homes. Those colleagues beyond the houses helped a lot too, because they explain us as it were.
Yeah. Were there any rules of conduct for living in the community, like no smoking, no drinking, anything like that?
We all smoked in the early days.
Okay.
I smoked until 72.
Mm-hmm.
And drinking, we had no ban on that.
Mm-hmm.
On the drugs, yes, we would do whatever we could to stop drugs from spreading. In those days, we were not open to the gate too much, but we did have homosexuals at times. But it wasn't like it was a rule, it was more like what is appropriate here and what is not. The way most things were handled was if there were questions about somebody's conduct, two or three of us would sit out and talk with them about it and try to work out something that was best for the community as well as for them as individuals.
Right. How did someone become a member of the community?
Mostly they just told us they were interested and we'd have a conversation with them. We agreed that they would be good to be a part of the community.
Did they have to be voted in, or?
No, I don't think it exactly voted. It was usually talked about both with them and the community. We talked about them some, perhaps, but it wasn't a vote.
Right.
It might have been like a consensus, but it was more of a ritual reception of them than it was.
Mm-hmm.
I don't recall us ever discussing some family as to whether or not they should be. That didn't happen very often. Most of the people we knew them already through programs.
Okay.
And so we were delighted when they decided to be part of us.
Right. But now, when somebody joined, were they required to give up their possessions, their assets to the community?
No, people did a lot of different things. Some people left their assets intact, either stored their furniture or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Some people sold them. Some people bought things with them as much as they could.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we encouraged that when we didn't have furniture.
Uh-huh.
But we never asked anybody to put all of their earnings into it. The only earnings that went into the pot were ones they earned to support themselves as a family while being a part of us. That began to change over the years so that the more of us were needed to run the operations and do things full time. like my wife and I were both full-time in the institute work. And so she went out fundraising a lot. She was a school teacher first, but then she became mostly in development, we call it fundraising. And I would be in research, or in the research office, or we were both taught on the weekends. Mm-hmm. So we didn't bring in income as such, though program income from a course. We really sold, gave away our programs.
Yeah.
We didn't. We would charge a fee that would pay for it, the cost of it, but
you
not
didn't
for
profit off
not from our salaries. Mm-hmm. We didn't get salaries out of that.
Yeah.
We got stipends out of our earnings of some of the people who worked out. In the early days, we all had one member of the family working out.
Mm-hmm. But was that a requirement?
Yes. Mm-hmm. The family had to be self-supported. We came back to that recently. What you see happening now,
yeah,
what I was describing up there, is because we've come full circle,
uh-huh,
back to the, each family has to support itself.
Right.
And so it's kind of stayed as a principle, but varied and it got large.
Mm-hmm. So when you were income sharing, you pooled your money and then a family would get an allowance based on the number of people.
But out of it would come food, and we had a health policy. For a while, we had an annuity program.
Mm-hmm. For retirement?
As we got large, we couldn't get everybody on the health and annuity, so we finally dropped it in 84. We got rid of both of those.
So now people have to have their own health insurance and their own retirement plans? And
mm-hmm. I have no retirement other than Social Security. I did get in. The Institute did pay some kind of symbolic salaries,
mm-hmm,
just to be a reputable institution.
Yeah.
We needed to pay some salaries, but I never saw the money. So
right.
I would get an institute salary and it would go into the pot.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, though, I was reporting Social Security and withholding tax.
Yeah.
And so I got enough quarters to have enough. And I had worked since I was 15 anyway, so I.
Mm-hmm.
I had plenty of quarters to get Social Security, but that's the only insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Right now I had other people have been able to get that, but some people had.
Is that frustrating at all to have worked for an organization and not have a plan?
Yeah,
yeah, it's too bad they didn't plan for that.
Well, we wanted to,
mm-hmm,
and we tried to, but we grew so fast, mm-hmm, and got so vast and so different.
Yeah.
By the time of 84, we had 700 Indians in India on our staff.
My goodness.
And we could not possibly do everything for everybody,
right,
that we wanted to.
Yeah.
And so, in many other locations too.
Mm-hmm.
Kenya and Africa, we had a large staff. Different places. We tried to, overseas, to have the institutes they were all separately incorporated as the Institute of Cultural Affairs in each country, separately. So we had no overarching. In 84, we began to get an international ICA in Brussels. But it wasn't exactly illegal. There is no worldwide legal structure.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can't incorporate it on the planet.
Yeah.
It's grown in that way,
mm-hmm,
and now it's not as large in terms of people living in residence, but in another way it's larger. People who came in January, for example, to a meeting in Dallas, Lynn Edwards said that she looked around the table and she knew out of 30 people, she only knew three,
mm-hmm,
and they were all here for facilitation,
mm-hmm,
training, and sharing. Facilitation. So in that way, it's larger.
Yeah, right.
But not living all in a community sense, mm-hmm, in the sense of doing the work together.
Well, yeah, your group has touched thousands and thousands of lives around
so
the globe.
If you counted all those,
mm-hmm,
and that's just one illustration of one group that meets together in North America,
mm-hmm,
or really in the United States, but it's there are similar kinds of relationships, associational relationships, in other countries too.
Right.
And so in that sense, it's larger than it was. Mm-hmm.
Now, during your more your community of goods period, can you describe some of the leadership and governmental process? Like, was Joe Matthews, was he kind of the leader, or?
Yes, he was a functional leader. We called him our symbolic head. And he played a, just personality-wise, he played a distinctive role in our group. But he was not our executive director or CEO.
Mm-hmm.
We had, like, when I was last here in the early 70s, early 80s, 79, we had four people here. This is after Joe's death. But we had four different divisions, research division is where I was. There was the funding, which was development, operations, which was the running the programs, and management, which kept the finances and the building of property and all of that. And there was a head of each of those. I was the research director. And while Joe was living, he felt very important to pass on the leadership, even the symbolic role. So he set up a five-person council. This happened in, let's see, I was in the Philippines, so it was about 70. A panjat, we call it, that's an Indian term from India. That's a village, every village in India has a panjat, it's a council of people. We had a five-person panjat, and it was both men and women. And they were our symbolic leaders while he was living with, along with him. Then after he died, they became the only symbolic heads we had.
And what does that mean, symbolic leader?
Well, their concern was to look after the whole process, where if I was in Research Central in Chicago, my major responsibility was here in North America, though I did some things overseas as well, but it was, his job was to look after the whole of the order and all of the institutes, the Ecumenical Institute and the Institute of Postal Affairs. And there are papers done on it. I'm not sure I can remember all the points of it, but there's a polity document that was written on it. You might be interested in that. We said that there were three major functions in any ruling body, or three dynamics in the way of making people rule themselves. One is the symbolic, one is the oligarchic, which is the few. That is, like the four heads of these departments I described would be a few. And then there were priors of the religious houses. Not everybody, just the priors. That would be a few. That would be priors' councils sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be the oligarchy.
Okay.
And then there's the democracy, where everybody has a voice.
Mm-hmm.
And those three work together so that they're held in tension with each other. And any of the three can hold accountable any of the others.
So you said democracy, oligarchy, and then what was the other one?
Symbolic.
Symbolic, okay.
In the old days, that would have been the monarchy.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't like the idea of the monarchy.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So we changed it to the symbolic. I think classical sociology would say monarchy, hierarchy. A hierarchy is made up of a monarchy, an oligarchy,
mm-hmm. Would you have described Joe Matthews as a charismatic person?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. He was someone that could very much motivate a group.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And he did many times. His function was to set a context for the direction we were going in, kind of spur us along in between, and usually either he or someone he worked with would summarize what happened
yeah.
after we'd done it.
Okay.
he played a big role in those areas, but in terms of day-by-day functioning, we pretty much operated in our teams, whether it be the work team or a house team. There were really two kinds of teams. One was one like the research team, where I was the prior of research. We would have anywhere from 6 to 12 people, and that would be one team. Another team would be looking after the programs. So he didn't interfere too often in those day-by-day activities, but he might come in and visit. Like, fundraising was always a big issue, so he played a big role in fundraising, and not only going in to meet with them, but also to go out and raise money. Some visits he would go on himself. But most of the fundraising, after it got to be very large, other people did it.
Yeah. One of the things that we're very interested in this project was the period from 1965 to 75, when a lot of youth in this country in particular were very interested in intentional community living and kind of getting together and living together. Were you affected by that at all? Did you have what you might call hippies coming to you and wanting to join? Or?
Yeah, I would say that interest started in the 50s, actually.
Oh, okay.
And that's why we went to the Faith and Life community. A lot of people came here just because they wanted community.
Mm-hmm.
But by 65 and 75, we had by 68, one of the things that was my responsibility was to get an academy started, an 8-week academy, and it was to train world churchmen, was one title we used, but it actually was attended by people who weren't churchmen too. And many of those people were students. They enjoyed coming to the academy because of the curriculum, which was a comprehensive culture curriculum, trying to deal with all of the disciplines, and it helped them to formulate their vocational decision.
Mm-hmm.
So we got a lot of students that way. So that was 68, would be right in the middle of that period.
Yeah.
We had all kinds of Students for Democratic Action.
Mm-hmm.
We had, I know one couple in particular came from, I think there were others, who we had a meeting here that I was in, of the Students for Democratic Action, and that must have been about that time too. And we kind of facilitated their planning for a nationwide meeting. Out of it, a couple decided, at least one couple decided to become a part of us as well. And so we had social activists in that way.
Yeah.
But we also had church people, pastors and their wives, Baptists. Pretty wide spectrum. In fact, if you had to take a kind of political profile of us, it would almost run the gamut.
Really?
In terms of political parties,
yeah,
there would be both Republicans and Democrats in this country.
Was there anything in common about the people that you attracted?
They had the horses with us, was the main thing. People from San Francisco would tend to be a little different that way. California. But people from New York and Boston would be different in their way. So it was really quite a multicultural community in a sense. I mean,
yeah.
We had some Jewish participation. Back in the Faith and Life community, I had a Buddhist roommate and from Thailand. So we've had diversity from the word go. We had some black and some Hispanic participation. Not in large numbers, but some all along.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you refer to the Faith and Life community, was that the community you had when you were in Texas?
That's when, yeah. Okay. We actually split in Austin.
Mm-hmm.
Some people stayed and some people came with us to Chicago.
Uh-huh.
There were 7 families that came up here, and I think 4 or 5 families that stayed there.
Okay.
And after that time, they went more into sensitivity training and the psychological development of people. But we went more sociological and more community development.
And the ones that stayed, did they continue to call themselves the Faith and Life Community? Okay.
Well, they actually took on the name of that other house, the Laos House.
The Laos House, okay.
It became mostly the Laos House, I think.
Does that still exist at all?
No, the building is still there. I went by it not too long ago, and the building's there, but it's now a student hostel. Sort of a dormitory for students. It's a beautiful old mansion. It had marble columns that were floated down the Brazos River. Mm-hmm. Big, huge columns.
Wow.
Painted yellow now, it really offended me. And the Faith and Life Community, the student house where the men's stayed, has been torn down.
Oh, okay.
Matthews and the students built a chapel on that ground before I got there, and it was all rock, entirely built out of rock and open. No doors or anything, you could just walk in, and so the weather didn't bother it. You could all walk inside and out. And had, you know, the daily office setup was up there.
Mm-hmm.
But a family decided they wanted to preserve that chapel, and so they moved it. Actually, picked up the stones and
moved it
to Lake Austin. And they're friends of the community. So it's still preserved, but not the actual facilities where the men's. The women lived down the street in another house, a large, just building a large house. And I don't know what's happened yet.
Okay. Can you describe some what led up to the dissolution of the Community of Goods? And I guess that was 1984? No, here.
Here.
And was that 84, 88? No. I'm not sure of the date exactly.
Well, there are similar reasons. In fact, Austin.
Okay.
On the surface, it's financial to a large degree. We've gotten so extended in 84 that we couldn't really make sure that every location could fund itself. Behind that, I think there was also a crisis in, well, I guess imagination to do programs, the kind of programs that would sell. Therefore, the finances went down. And underneath that, I think, was a spirit crisis of our own motivity and decision to be corporate, continue to be corporate, and work together. And I think that's the heart of the issue, the spirit crisis. Could say it started with Matthew's death in 77, but it was not evident to us in 77. And for 7 years at least, we maintained pretty well. I was reading some of the documents the other day out of the 84 conference and the council, and we had no intention of going out of being when we met in 84.
Mm-hmm.
But in the years that followed, we had a long-term investment team here in Chicago that met, and they just could not figure out our viability financially as a group, as we were. That's when we went back to this every person or every family unit has to support itself.
Right.
And that meant when I came back from India, I had to support myself. In fact, one reason I came back from India is there's no way I could work over there except to teach in an American school, which I did for a month, but I didn't really want to do that, and so I came back here, and I was single by that time, and I worked here for 2 months in Chicago, and then went to New York, and worked until my mother fell and broke her hip. I didn't have anything else tying me down there. I was still doing temp work, though I was about to get a permanent job. I decided to go home to Texas. So that's the way it happened with me. They went where they had to go to earn a living or wanted to go.
That must have been real hard for some of the older members.
Yeah, and to translate the skills we have internally into the market of the world, and it's where I've struggled, and I think the other people have too. Because we have a lot of skills, but they're not all the ones that people would recognize, corporation, other business or other organization.
Are there things that you miss about that kind of shared life?
Yeah. There's both sides to it. There's some relief of not having the burden of it, and there's some regret of not having the support of it either. But it's you know, kind of a both end.
You know,
have a good time being back here, even though things are not what they were when I was here before. It's changed a lot.
In what ways has it changed?
Well, not eating the meals all together, not worshiping together, that sort of things.
Yeah.
It's left up to individuals to do. And in a way, that's appropriate to our time now, I think. It's like the spirit move today is not toward community, it's toward being fully authentic and independent yourself. And that, I think that's a social trend as well as in us, that you have to be able to be independent and support yourself. That's true of nations as well as it is individuals. A lot of dependency gets built up. That was one of the big issues, I think, too, behind our dividing up. People had become so dependent upon the community that they weren't taking full responsibility for themselves.
Uh-huh.
And so it had its right side about it, but it had its painful side about it as well. So I don't know about people entering community today. I think it's up to people if that's right for them. No, it's fine. Right? I have nothing against it. It's just I wonder what their motivation is today. I think it's different than it was in the 50s and 60s.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how exactly it was different and why they would. Maybe they understand more than we did about the need for purpose and mission. That kind of had to grow with us. In the College House in Austin, the last year or two, like in 60, 61, 62, we had started, had just begun doing what we call sodalities. They were groups of students who focused on usually some issue in the university because they were all university students. And so we would have a missional group as well as a study group to go to. And that was just the beginning when we divided and came up here. So we were urging other people to be mission in their local church, but we had not found the focus for our mission until we came to Chicago and moved to the West Side. And it was for a very good reason. We were getting people excited at the end of the course, but we didn't have anything to show them.
Right.
And we really couldn't say, what do you need to do back in your hometown?
Uh-huh.
So we had to learn to do it ourselves.
Right.
And it took us 10 years to figure out our approach to social life. We were not all sociologists by any means. And had a large number of teachers, ministers, few sociologists, but most of us were not even trained in that. And the method we had created was not the caseworker approach. It was more of a team approach and more of a dealing with the whole community instead of individual family casework.
Right.
Though that got dealt with in the process of dealing with the community. You start a preschool, you're going to deal with the grandmothers and the mothers and others that take care of them and release them to work while the children are in preschool or that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So you affected families, but you didn't take on each family separately like the caseworker usually does. So we had to invent a different approach to community development. That's what took us 10 years to figure out.
Right. Yeah. I've studied a number of organizations or movements or churches. Sometimes they go by different names that seem to go through a communal phase and then they go into something different. Is that kind of the way you would describe what you've done? Is you've gone through it? You went from being individual families, went through a communal phase, and now are back being more to individual families. Is that how you would describe
more individual,
that?
But more. functioning as a business, too.
Okay.
You have to make enough income on what you're doing mm-hmm. to support yourself.
Right.
And so you couldn't just give away your programs anymore.
Yeah, that's right.
We really gave away our programs for years. We, as I said, make the program self-supporting itself.
Yes.
But we didn't get income from it.
Right.
In fact, we were kind of against getting income from it. Mm-hmm. But we did have other people, some of us working out to support the rest of us. So.
So now you see it
now
more as a business than a charity. Or,
right. Uh-huh. It's got to be a cost center that yeah. has income and covers its own expenses.
Mm-hmm.
And there are places where groups of people are doing the same business together. Here in Chicago, there's one called CanBay. That stands for Canada Bombay.
Okay.
It has a Canadian background in it and an Indian background. A lot of the people that are in it worked in India. And many of them were fundraisers. And they get people from India who do programming and computers together with people called corporations in this country who need programmers. And they get that's one thing they do. So they do some strategic planning and so forth too. But that's kind of where they make their most money, and it's growing rapidly.
So even though you have...
That's a business where a group of our people, so to speak, have formed. They have also hired some other people who are not mm-hmm. they're not employees.
Right.
Lim works there 2 days a week.
Okay.
The woman who started the archives worked, Betty Pessin, mm-hmm. is working there. So mm-hmm. they both
so
had to have income from someplace.
Right. So even though you've dissolved your community of goods...
through another phase, and whether it, you know, ever needs that kind of cohesion again, I don't know. It's just not as cohesive as it once was.
Uh-huh.
There's different parts that are doing different things. Like ICA West is in Phoenix, located in Phoenix, but it covers, I think, everything west of the Mississippi. And Seattle has a group of people of ICA. Working somewhat together too. And they are part of ICA West. And they are taking that book I showed you by Laura Spencer on sharing, Winning Through Participation. The name of it is TOP, Technology of Participation.
Mm-hmm.
The TOP program has now been developed by Phoenix and ICA West to be its major program that it offers. They have a manual to deal with it, and they train people in that manual to deal with it. You sign an agreement to be part of the faculty staff to do that. And so they have a kind of cohesiveness that's different than ICA Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Though some of ICA Chicago go to their meetings, so they're still interlocking between. In fact, we're going to have a joint meeting in 2 weeks for everybody in the ICA and United States. There's some other people from the East Coast that do that too. So it's
things are still happening.
Yeah, it's still, and it's kind of been months. Whether it ever comes under one canopy again or not, I don't know. Maybe it doesn't need to.
Mm-hmm.
It does have one board of directors that we're legally responsible for. So while I'm here, I'm paid by ICA Chicago, but we're all answerable to this nationwide board. That's.
Are you on the board?
No.
No.
No, these are people outside of the staff.
Oh, okay.
They're lawyers and doctors.
Mm-hmm.
And people that. People of influence in meetings, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Or part of the board that represent us to the legal structures. They incorporate only in the state of Illinois, but function nationwide. ICA West is also incorporated. Responsible to Arizona, but it's like interlocking and overlapping or something.
Yeah.
One of the decisions they might make in 2 weeks is whether or not that's should they continue that operate that way, but encourage regional boards to be set up
mm-hmm.
or not.
Mm-hmm.
separately. Because they do need boards not only for legal representation, but also for practical business advice.
Leadership and guidance.
Yeah, just counselors, advisors mm-hmm. to their programs, the market, and that sort of thing.
So there's some decentralization underfoot then.
Right.
Yeah. Now, it seems like the ICA has been a tremendously successful and influential organization, you know, growing from a pretty small group to this huge international group it is now. What are some of the ingredients for its success, do you think?
Well, I would say the first one is being able to pinpoint where the spiritual and social need is at the moment. To use the New Testament, that you're able to read the signs of the times in which you live. And we have usually been very good at that. For example, right now, I would say where people's needs are, though there's a lot of social need, a lot of economic need. People are doing things in those areas, need spiritual support, and probably practices of meditation mm-hmm. are as much needed as strategic planning is needed. We've not yet formulated, we call that our third campaign, which has never operated as a campaign. We did Awakenment and Impact with leadership training courses. We did social restructuring through community development and organizational development. But we've never done we've done a lot of spirit life on ourselves. We even had a program called the Odyssey once that people out of the regions came to, but they were mostly close colleagues who've been through other programs. But we've never publicly gone out to offer forms of meditation or prayer. But we did a lot of that in our summer assemblies. We did the research assemblies and in the board of councils. We did things like a fast or things like a watch. But we've never tried to market that. We've never tried to involve people. Whether or not we decide to do that, I don't know, but I think that's really where the current need is. For mm-hmm.
It's like your RS1 course, that's kind of what you need to be teaching?
RS1 is still needed. I mean, people haven't thought through for themselves their own theology. Mm-hmm. They need to.
Yeah.
That they buy ours, mm-hmm. but that they think through for themselves. Mm-hmm. What do they mean by God, Christ, Holy Spirit, and Church?
Yeah. Is RS1
if they're Hindu, they need to do something similar to that, mm-hmm. which no one's ever created a Hindu RS1.
Right.
And I know, but probably it's going on in some form in India. And in fact, I got trained in Pranayama Yoga when I was in India. I can still practice it when I choose to, but it's the decision to the Hindu struggle is how do you share something as close and intimate as meditation is? There's a man named Goenka who was a businessman, and he's now doing Vipassana yoga, sitting, standing, walking meditation, and it's all over the country. There's a place near Dallas that Lynn went down to one of those programs. Is that their form of RS1? Maybe it is.
Yeah.
It's not a theology course, it's a meditation course. So we need to learn from them, maybe.
Okay.
So that's why this experiment with Tai Chi is going on here. Mm-hmm. We also learned Taekwondo one summer, 84. So in the 84 council, we
wow.
had a wide array of these, you know. Mm-hmm. There's a woman named Jean Houston that some of us got involved with. I worked with her for about 5 years. And, not all the time, but off and on. And she does a lot of visualization. She does a lot of
different forms of ritual and acting things out. And she calls it a theropia that they do for healing of people. We said back in the 60s that that we were not the spirit movement, we were a part of a spirit movement. Mm-hmm. But there's a broad spirit movement happening that is even more so now. And I think it's usually called the consciousness movement, or it used to be called, until some pretty kooky things got around, the New Age movement. Mm-hmm. Someplace it still is, I guess. It's just widespread. So I went to a course in Dallas. I was trying to find more work, different kinds of work. And so the Texas Employment Commission advised me to go to this Recreating Your Future program. So I went, and it turned out to be consciousness movement.
Uh-huh.
And they did a lot of the same practices I'd learned at the Qing Wisdom. It's a broad thing.
Yeah.
It's happening in that. I think it's something that we need to be even more involved in somehow.
Mm-hmm.
You do have to have what Ignatius Loyola used to talk about as discernment of spirits, because you have to decide between things, and some things are harmful and some things are helpful. But that's going to always be the case, I think. When a spirit breaks loose, you don't know what the spirit's going to do, because as Jesus said, the wind blows where it lists.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to have some good things and it's going to have some bad things. And if you're going to live in it, you've got to live in a certain way. And we're having a PSU on the archives of June here, and it's on the other world. I told you about
PSU, is that what you said?
It's a problem solving unit.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is, how do we make our work on the other world accessible to more people? What would we do?
And what does the other world mean? I'm not quite clear on that.
It's the spirit world.
Okay.
There's this everyday mundane life that you and I live every day. And there's, at the same time this is going on, there is a spirit dimension to what we're doing. And it's just a given that there's that. That's just as real a part of it as sitting here is. What are the different states of being in that?
Uh-huh.
And that's why we call them consciousness or river consciousness. Fountain of care.
Yeah, could you tell me again what those were? There was like the Sea of Tranquility.
Sea of Tranquility.
Okay.
And that's where there's peace at the center. You used to talk about it as heaven or the kingdom of God. The Mountain of Care, which is simply your spirit dimension where you care for other people. There's the river of consciousness, and the land of mystery. It's possible to either decide to live in that. Some people aren't even aware that it exists, and yet they're in it.
Okay.
And other times, you become so involved in the spirit dimension that you know it. That's when you sing a great song with people and everybody gets in the same spirit together. It's like they're in our atmosphere, our environment. I used to push the young people around the house in Houston. Why did they like to play their music so loud? And they'd tell me, I want an environment to be my environment. And so they play loud music. Well, that same kind of environment happens. Sometimes it happens in a public meeting. Sometimes it happens to you individually where you're meditating. You enter into another dimension of reality. They call it sometimes an altered state of being. We usually talk about it as the awe, A-W-E, when the awe comes in. That's the land of mystery. And they're different. We talked about it as 64 states of being. We're quite clear that there are probably millions of states of being in the spirit dimension of life, but it's Joseph Campbell talked about it in The Hero of a Thousand Faces as the sacred, the realm of the sacred. as compared to the realm of the profane or the mundane. And there's a journey, the hero goes through the journey, and this journey of sacred, he has steps on the journey.
Right.
It's really quite a thing to read.
Yeah.
And Jean Houston does an exercise in which she'll take a group of people through the different steps that Campbell articulated. She actually has you act it out.
Wow.
So that if you meet a, what do you call them, those guardian of the thresholds, at every threshold in life that you go through spiritually, there's some guardian there that's out to stop you from going through that. And so you might play the guardian of that threshold for me, and I would play it for you.
Mm-hmm.
She'd have you act that out.
Interesting.
There are different thresholds that you have to go through. But it's, yeah, she's quite a person. I call her an ecologist of culture. One thing, or at least one thing she does, it helps you, like she does these things on Hinduism and Buddhism and these other religions. She's trained in both psychology and whatever else it is. She has two PhDs.
Wow.
And, well, she was an actress originally. And that's the reason I got so fascinated with her, because we used to do a course, still do a course, I guess, on the images. It's the six major world cultures. There's the black culture. There's the white culture. There's the red man, Native American culture. There's the Chinese yellow man culture. There's the brown man or the subcontinent culture. And what's the sixth one? Tan man or the Muslim world culture. Those are the six major world cultures we talked about. It doesn't deal, we realized later, with the Pacific Island cultures, but that might be another one. Then we taught the six or images. We, in that course, we tried several things that helped people get inside of another culture. Western culture, we think more in verbal terms and rational terms, intellectual. That is our culture. Other cultures don't. They have their own intelligence. So it's not that we're more intelligent than they are, but when you go to India, you're much more conscious of being a part of a people, a family. And the same in Chinese culture, there's more identification of family and their culture than we do. Indian culture is much more self and spirit related. And there's always intermixtures of these, but anyway, we have a course that teaches those. And we do things like have a paper sack full of all kinds of stuff. Some stuff would be gooey, and some stuff would be hard, and some stuff would be rough, some would be soft and spongy. And you imagine yourself in Africa, and you're reaching in there, and you're touching these various different things. And what would it mean to learn that way, rather than learning just intellectually? Mm-hmm. I think Jean goes beyond us.
Right.
For the kind of exercises she does in this case. One thing she has you do is you get down on the floor, lie on the floor, and imagine yourself a fish. And you wiggle around or whatever. Imagine yourself swimming around as a fish. And then you become an amphibian. She goes through the whole process of evolution, the monkey, and you act out being a monkey, you know, until the final level state of evolution, being a human being. It's really quite an experience.
It sounds like it.
She claims, and a lot of psychologists claim, that every one of us go through those phases. When we were children, we call our own mother, and we act kind of like, well, in your mother's womb, you're swimming, actually.
Right.
And so we go through all those stages in personal development. So that's her major intent, is to help people develop their own potential.
Mm-hmm. And would you say that's what the ICA is about, is human potential?
Yes. Uh-huh. We have come to it a little more verbal, but we're not exclusively verbal.
Yeah.
I think our singing goes beyond it.
Right.
The use of music and general.
Yeah. Now, you said the movement started out as being a movement to re-energize churches. Is that, would that be a way of describing it? And then how would you describe it today? If you, I know it's probably hard to do that in a sentence or two, but.
Well, the churches in our culture are the, or have been the devotional life of the people through the Christian church. In another culture, it would be something else, Buddhist temples, Hindu temples, temple life. And initially, we felt that that was the place to begin. Now, it's like unless you can also deal with the social context that people are in, they don't have a way of acting out in the church. You know, and that's what we found at every local church. They struggled the most with how to be missioned to their own town, their own community, whatever it was. They may not define their community geographically like we did, but they still struggle with the issue of mission. They would give to missions financially, maybe overseas, or but in terms of themselves being involved in mission, each person or together as a congregation is very important. And we think that's still one of the major claims on us. So what we're doing, in one sense, is demonstrating to people how you can care for society, as well as, so in a way we're still the church, but we're at another phase of it. I think we also have things to say back to the church now that we need to say, but that's side point. I think we're through, well, we've learned how to do the social corporations. I work with a police department once in India. Work with a teacher's training school, all different kinds of organizations we've worked with. But we need to also find ways, as I said earlier, spirit undergirding for people who are doing that work. Because there are a lot of other people doing as well or better than we are in those same kind of efforts to renew. A lot's happening inside of corporations today. That's more human than it was before. Teamwork is almost taken for granted now. You have to work as teams. We know a lot about how to do teams. And so we're still effective in working with them. But it's like if you're really a pioneer, you're going to go on to the next stage that's needed.
Yes.
And I think it's how do you support other people who are doing.
So maybe you take the community leaders and you give them spiritual undergirding, is that what you were saying?
Could be, yeah. Or a team of people say this team is on the line of a manufacturing process and they're a cost center or some particular part of it. How do they support themselves spiritually as they do their work?
Right. Would you say, is your work at all similar to Stephen Covey's work?
It's related. I think he's adding stuff to this, to that. But we do. I think we have a little different approach than he has. I don't know it real well. But.
It's just he talks a lot about spiritual,
The
spiritual side and how that needs to be nurtured.
Yeah. No, I think there's a lot happening there in the world, so it's something we all need to be involved in somehow.
Do you see the ICA is continuing?
Well, it's hard to say whether it is continuing. Mm-hmm. It's not continuing in the same form it was in before.
Yeah.
And some of it doesn't even call itself an ICA anymore.
Oh, okay.
But does that mean it's not there? I don't think it means that. It just means it's you know what shapeshifters are.
No, I don't.
There's a novel or two written about shapeshifters. In fact, I saw a shapeshifter on Star Trek last night.
Okay.
This was a woman who could literally change her shape into whatever shape she wanted to.
But anyway, I think we're going through more something like that, where you change shape and form to deal with. Maybe we're more like what is this animal? That, chameleon.
Mm-hmm.
We're more like chameleons now. Because our world is changing so fast that from one moment to the next almost, and certainly one day to the next, you have to play different functions and roles.
Yes.
And it becomes so overwhelming sometimes because you think you ought to be in control of it and manage it. That's what we're trained. Rather than just changing shape and shifting with it, going with the flow of it. And we, not many of us have learned how to do that very well. I haven't, I'm still learning. Going with the flow is a big, it requires what Matthew Fox calls letting go. I'm reading a book now that he wrote on wrestling with the prophets. And he says to be a prophet, like in the Old Testament prophets, you have to, first of all, let go of whatever's happening in your society or your community or your culture. And then you can interfere. And that's what a prophet does. A prophet interferes with whatever's happening. It's like you have to be able to do that in lots of different ways right now. I don't, that's probably why it's right for us not to all be under one roof and one canopy anymore. Because we do need to be adapting ourselves to whatever context we're in. You wish we could have some way of, I don't know what the right metaphor is for it, but orchestrating it. Like there needs to be a symphony going on rather than a clamor.
Uh-huh.
In a symphony, you've got a lot of different instruments playing a lot of different parts. They sometimes even seem discordant, like in the Rite of Spring.
Mm-hmm.
When it was played in Paris, you remember what happened in Paris?
People walked out?
Oh, or? They went wild.
Oh, they did.
Because it was so discordant.
Uh-huh.
Now, we're kind of used to that now,
yeah.
Because that was the turn of the century. And a lot of our music is distorted there. But you have the feeling that if world peace were really to come, there would be a way for Hindus and Buddhists and Muslims, all these other things to play their part.
Yes.
And it'd be a grand symphony. It would be rich, but somehow the same score, or you're never going to have world peace. And I don't know who in the world could compose such a symphony as that, but that's what's needed. I think that's what harmony really means. It doesn't mean everybody doing the same thing. Harmony means like a bass and a tenor and an alto and a soprano, only there's not just four parts anymore, there's several hundred or thousands of parts, millions. So you gotta, well, when we were asked to write down our mission statement, our purpose, and just recreating your future, of course I took my son. That's what I wrote down as my purpose, was to find the ways to not only write the score, but play the symphony with the minds and hearts of Earth people of world peace.
Wow. Yeah, that's wonderful.
It's a little grandiose,
well,
and it's plain, but it helps me put in perspective what I'm trying to do right now.
Right.
And, I haven't found anybody that would inform me for more than 6 months to do it. It's maybe that's not what we're looking for anymore, is a place to work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe we don't know. But you do have to support yourself somewhere.
That's right.
So I'm trying to be also a freelance writer.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And write, starting with fiction. I'm writing fiction and then a contest and all. And maybe I can support myself as a writer. But,
have you ever thought about writing about this group and its history?
Well, anything I write is going to be this group's history. I mean, a little section of it, at least. The best thing I've written so far is called Down Is Up. And it's about my trip to Nepal, from India. I was going to Nepal just to get out of village development for a little while and visit the Himalayan mountains. Mm-hmm. So I was going up. But while I was going up, I was also romantically related to a young woman. She turned me down, so I was down.
Down, yeah.
And down was up. But then once I made my trip as far up the mountains as I could get, which was much more in foothills, but I got up and my spirits came up. And especially when I came back down the mountain, I was up. They like that story. It's just about a walk. It's describing a walk up the mountain. A tree I meditated before. Kids on along the way. Then I decided to enter this contest. I wrote 1,500 words. And I decided to enter this contest, and the contest wanted 3,500 words.
Oh.
So I added a preface on the beginning and a conclusion on how it went. To the mall and everything that happened on me on the way up there and going home to Bombay. I didn't want to touch the middle part because it was pretty good like it was.
Yeah.
We'll see. I'll know
next
month whether I'm going to make it in the writing world or not.
All right. Well,
it's hard to be an art writer.
Well, hey, thank you so much for your time. I know you're busy, so I appreciate this.
Well, I